All right.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call a meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2927.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2927 enacts interstate compact for agreement among states to elect the president by national popular vote. That comes to you. We do not have the fiscal revenue yet, Madam Chair. We have received, as of about 15 minutes ago, 224 pieces of testimony available on OLIS. So please, if you do not see your testimony, please let us know, and we will make sure it gets up there.
All right, and I'm going to invite up Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer, Justin Martin, and Dr. Koza. And as you come up, I want to talk a minute about what we're going to do here today. So we are going to limit public testimony to 2 minutes. Because we have so many people that that are signed up to testify, our job up here is to listen. So you won't be getting questions from us at this time. We want to get as many people in as possible to give their comments. So please respect the 2 minute mark. Finish up as soon as that buzzes, because you're taking somebody else's time if you go over 2 minutes, and we want to get as many voices on the record as possible. If you've heard, if somebody's making the same points you were planning on making, please shorten up your testimony or submit it online, because we want to get, like I said, as many voices and as many separate perspectives as possible. You can submit your testimony, written testimony, to the committee at hrules, all one word, .exhibits@oregonlegislature.gov. So if you haven't submitted your written testimony, please do. If we don't get to you, please know that we will all read all of that testimony, I promise, on behalf of every member of this committee. And with that, we are going to ask Dr. Kozik to come back up at the last few minutes of the committee, so we can ask questions if we have them. If we can't get to them, because we are adjourning this meeting at 4:45, we have other committee meetings and obligations on behalf of members of this committee. So we'll ask Dr. Koza some final questions, or we'll get them to you in writing so that you can give us written responses, and we can share that with the committee. So with that, Representative Kenny Geyer, would you like to kick it off?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, State Representative for House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. Our country's electoral college system of electing our president and vice president is flawed and outdated, and it is time to replace it with a national popular vote. I am honored to co-chief sponsor House Bill 2927 with Representative Rayfield and Senator Boquist, and I appreciate the many bipartisan efforts here in Oregon and around the country to pass the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. I am honored to sit alongside Dr. John Koza, a longtime champion of this effort. His organization, National Popular Vote, has a bipartisan board comprised of 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats. Its website, nationalpopularvote.com, has many details and myth-busting video clips. I won't go into detail about the origins of the Electoral College, given the number of people here to testify. However, I do want to note that in 1789, our forefathers couldn't comprehend that voters could make an informed decision about candidates outside of their region due to limited communication. This is clearly not the case now. The Electoral College does not fit the we the people and one person, one vote style of government. Oregon's votes don't count as much in a presidential election as in swing states. In fact, they usually don't count at all. Nearly all of the candidate advertising and visits, other than for fundraising, occurs in 12 swing states, and most of that is in 6 states. Post-election implications of our current system are equally important. Battleground states receive 7% more federal grants than spectator states such as ours, twice as many presidential disaster declarations, more Superfund enforcement exemptions, and more exemptions to No Child Left Behind. Oregon deserves a voice in who becomes president. This bill ensures that every vote in every state will matter in every presidential election. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of National Popular Vote. I will be brief since Dr. Koza is here, and I know that time is limited and we need to hear from the public. We are in support of House Bill 29, 27. The national popular vote bill would guarantee the presidency to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states plus the District of Columbia. We have currently passed 11 jurisdictions, totaling 165 electoral votes, which is 61% of the votes needed to trigger this compact that you will hear about from Dr. Koza in just a moment. The bill has also passed at least one chamber in 12 states, including the Oregon House in 2009, 2013, and 2015. And I've been very proud to work on this issue for the last 10 years, and let's hope we get over the finish line this time. I know you're all tired of hearing from me on this issue. Why is this relevant to Oregon, and why is this relevant to me as an Oregonian? I believe wholeheartedly that my vote as an Oregonian should matter just as much as a vote from Ohio, or a vote from Florida, or a vote from Pennsylvania. And under this current system, my vote does not matter, nor do the 800,000 Republican votes that were cast in the presidential election matter. That's because of the winner-take-all rule that was passed by a state legislature that you will hear about from Dr. Koza. But the reality is, we need to make Oregon relevant, and my vote as an Oregonian, everybody in this room's vote as an Oregonian, and your vote as an Oregonian should count just as much as any other person in this state. You heard Representative Kenny Guyer say, every vote should be equal in every state in every presidential election. So that's why I'm here. That's why my colleague Tom Barrows feels so strongly about this. It also matters in governance. It's not just on the front end of presidential campaigns. It's about what happens once you become president and what kind of policies you pass because of those battleground states. We should be talking about issues that are relevant to all of us. We should be talking about natural resources. We should be talking about Pacific Rim trade. We should be talking about high tech. And unfortunately, we just don't talk about that in presidential elections. So that's another reason why Oregon should be relevant. And I can guarantee that everybody in this room today can agree, and everybody in this state can agree, and everybody in this country can agree that every vote should be equal for every citizen in this country. You're going to hear testimony today about a lot of myths and a lot of confusing items, but the reality is this, and this bill really does two things. It would ensure that every vote in every state is equal, and the candidate that gets the most votes will win. So thank you very much for your time today, and we look forward to having a continued discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Koza.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and the rest of the committee, I'm John Koza, K-O-Z-A, Chair of National Popular Vote. Governor Scott Walker, when he was running for president about a year ago, said the country as a whole is not going to elect the next president. 12 states are. And that's the reality that stems from the winner-take-all law that Oregon has as a state law and that 47 other states have as their state law that give all of your electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most votes inside the state. And the consequence of the winner-take-all law in 2012, for example, was that 100% of the campaign events and virtually all the campaign expenditures were in 12 states. And similarly in 08 and in 2016, 94% of the post-election, general election campaign events were in 12 states again. 38 states are left out. All of their issues are left out. And that's the primary disadvantage of the winner-take-all rule, namely that presidential candidates, for example, in 12, only campaigned in states that were between 45% and 51% for Romney, or in other words, 48%, which is his national number, plus or minus 3%. And if you're not in that narrow band, and Oregon is certainly not, you're simply irrelevant in presidential campaigns. The other aspect of the winner-take-all rule, of course, is that five of our 45 presidents have come into office without having won the most votes nationwide. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we'll do panels for public testimony. We'll do a panel of proponents, a panel of opponents, and then a neutral panel if we are any. I'm going to have Aaron call folks up.
And so the first panel is Marge Isley, Paula Grisafi. I apologize if I mispronounce your name, and Kate Titus.
Welcome, and start in any order you'd like. Just be sure to identify yourself for the record. And we'll have your time on the board.
Good afternoon. My name is Marge Easley, and I am here on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I think that most folks are familiar with the League. We have been around for nearly 100 years protecting the right to vote. We believe strongly that every vote should be counted equally, and we believe in the concept of one person, one vote. We strongly support HB 2927. And this support is not related to the 2016 election or to any previous election. We have supported the direct election of the president for the past 47 years. This is a long-term goal of ours, and we will continue this goal for a long time in the future. Our founding fathers believed that the Constitution was a great experiment in democracy. They disagreed on how much power people should have, however. In a loose collection of states at that time when people were far flung from each other. They came upon the compromise of electors to act as intermediaries, and as Alexander Hamilton said, to insulate the president's election from the passions of the masses. One of the myths that you may hear today is that we need to protect the interests of small states or the rights of the minority. However, if you look at the beginnings of the Electoral College, you will see that this was not their goal, the Founding Fathers' goal. It was to appease slaveholding states because slaves included in their population count the slaves, and they counted as three-fifths of a person. So the slaveholding states were given that benefit of being able to count those in their population counts. Whereas a direct election of the president would not. The founders did not envision.
Thank you.
Welcome.
No, can't do that.
I want to start a trend.
Hello, my name is Paula Grisafi. The winner state. The winner-take-all system is not constitutionally mandated. States are free to allocate their electoral votes as they wish. During the earliest presidential elections, only three states used the winner-take-all model, and that was eliminated by 1800. Today we have a system that elects a president chosen by a minority of voters twice in the last two decades. But this is less a product of the Electoral College and more a product of the way states apportion their electors. If a candidate wins a state by even a very small margin, he or she will wins all the state electors. I believe that no one who loses the popular vote should be president of this country. I don't think this is a partisan issue. I think it's common sense and fairness. Not only does it delegitimize the person in the eyes of many here and around the world, but it undermines basic concepts of our democracy, that a person's vote matters and that we are all equal. I've read many of the letters that have been in the hearing materials, and the major concern in opposition seems to be that passage of this bill would disenfranchise Oregonians. That concern would be valid only if this bill were passed and then immediately enacted, and not as it is worded, to go into effect only after enough states pass it to reach the threshold of 270 electoral votes to elect their president. As written, it actually will enfranchise all Oregonians, including those in the minority who currently have their votes effectively negated by the current system. Currently, enough states have passed this compact to reach 165 electoral votes, and it's moving through other legislatures. I hope that our legislature will see fit to pass this bill. I believe it is the fair and the right thing to do.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is Kate Titus, and I'm here on behalf of Common Cause Oregon. And as most of you, I believe, know, Common Cause is an organization that works for open, honest, and accountable government. and we're here in support of the measure. I would use a moment of my time to just say I would use, if you have a chance to read the full testimony of my colleague from the League of Women Voters later, I think the historical perspective they bring is quite interesting. So I recommend that. Common Cause has been coming here before you on this measure at least since the 2011 session. I think this is a really important bill for democracy on a number of counts. One, equalizing the vote, as has been discussed here, that it respects every vote. Putting Oregon back on the map so that our votes matter here by really incentivizing a full 50-state presidential race. Increasing voter confidence. We know that Americans and Oregonians have a sense of fair play. And when you see that a president gets elected without the majority vote, it breeds cynicism. And finally, increasing participation. What we have seen that in general, the participation rates are higher in swing states where voters are in play. All these, I think, are really important reasons. I would just close by saying that I think this is an issue that is neither a conservative issue or a liberal issue. It's one that we should all be able to get behind. It's really just about the appropriate workings of our government. Thank you.
Next panel is Janice Deisinger, Andrew Nisbet, and George Strubel.
Like, just remember to say your name for the record, please.
Okay, fair enough. My name's Andrew Nisbet, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The compact that we're being asked to enter into is here to address two different problems. The first of these problems is presidential elections wherein the holder of the most popular votes does not get the majority in the Electoral College. While we have had two of those elections in the past 20 years, in fact, there have only been four of them in the history of the Republic. I don't count the election of 1824, and if you want to know why, look at a footnote that I threw in. But the fact of the matter is that this is not a common phenomenon. The longest gap between these two elections occurred prior to the 2000 election and was 112 years. One of these elections did not occur at all during the 20th century. So I am less impressed by the urgency of dealing with this problem than some of the proponents. The second question is a question of equity, and for some reason, my vote does not count just because my candidate in this state always loses. And we could, in fact, measuring equity by measuring battleground states is just weird because it ignores the actions of political parties, it ignores the primaries, and it pretends that a national coalition is built by one guy traveling around the country in public meetings for 3 months, once every 4 years. I'm not sure that's how a national coalition is built, and I don't particularly feel offended that I was going to have a hard time getting around Portland because a presidential candidate was clogging up the road from the airport.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Janice Deisinger, and I'm with Oregonians for Fair Elections. I sent you some testimony, and it included both the Heritage Foundation white paper, which discusses a lot of the problems with the national popular vote, and I also sent you Federalist Paper number 68 by Hamilton. And I only wanted to focus on one thing, as our time is limited, and that is that this is clearly a compact. And the compact clause, I believe Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, says no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty or tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit delay. And I believe that this clearly violates the compact clause because we don't have any, we're not being invaded or having any imminent danger. I seriously doubt if Congress will consent to it. It will put, if enacted, it will put our country in a constitutional crisis. In a very short window of time, we'll have a great deal of problem, and it will not promote peace within our nation. If the proponents of this law want to have a national popular vote, they should do so by amending the Constitution. That's the proper way to go about it rather than doing this end run around the Constitution. And I would ask you to please vote no on this bill. The one thing that Hamilton said about this that I thought was very interesting, he said that if it is not a perfect system, what was laid out in the Constitution, it is at least excellent. And it promoted the security against mischief by selecting people who were not. Thank you.
I'm George Struble. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This bill, HB 2927, would enable the effectiveness of massive election fraud that would destroy the election integrity of our presidential elections, an opposite effect of the goals of the proponents. Consider a state, or several of them, in which one party is dominant and in which there is a proclivity toward electoral shenanigans. I'm sure a few such states come to your mind. Under the Electoral College, there is no incentive to massive electoral fraud in the presidential election in those states. The state's electoral votes go to the state's dominant party. It's very simple. Under the national popular vote, that state's leaders have a strong incentive to pad the state's margin by a million or so votes, thereby swinging the national election results. The leaders in such states have opportunities for massive electoral fraud. There are several states in which voting is done by electronic machines and no actual recount is possible. Each machine is only capable of re-reporting its totals. Vote counting software is vulnerable. Even if an effective recount is possible, a state in which massive fraud has been committed can avoid doing a recount. Typically, recounts are triggered only when elections are close. In a state where the reported result is not close, the election officials can avoid doing a recount and, in fact, would have a strong incentive to certify its results without a recount.
Thank you.
We have one neutral party, so Les Poole, and then Eileen Revy and Darlene Carlson.
I'll go ahead and start. Good afternoon, Les Poole. I'm from Clackamas County. I signed up as neutral because I'm intrigued by this. And the more I hear the testimony, the more I actually start to lean towards opposed. I've got questions, and obviously I don't expect them all to be answered here or discussed here, but it appears like this is somewhat of a convoluted way to get to a place that may be honorable. And the gentleman before me, or I believe it was the lady before me, you know, questioned, you know, how are we getting there? I'm a little concerned about that. My other concerns, real simple, and the best way I thought to express it was it occurred to me, I look at the lottery. Oregon gets involved in the nationwide Powerball. Okay, we're all players now. We're all in this conglomerate. The truth is, how often or how much bigger is Oregon's voice in that lottery? How often does someone from Oregon win the Powerball? And it might seem like a stretch, but I'm trying to say that we're now talking about making a major change. This is a major change to the structure of how people are elected in this country. And in doing so, how does that really benefit or give Oregon a bigger voice? Our population, our percent of involvement remains the same. We're still 3.5 or 4 million people. So I see a situation where what we've always seen, the states with more population are going to carry it. I believe fully that regardless of how this spins down, you're going to see more and more campaigning in the most populous states, and Oregon's stature, I don't see it changing. If someone could come up here and address that or put that in a perspective, I might go back to neutral. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Darlene Carlson from Portland, Oregon. To me, the most compelling thing about the National Popular Vote Compact is that every vote cast for president gets added up, and we can see who had the most and who had the second. And every other election in this country, from the time we're in grade school on up, the person, the candidate with the most vote wins. And this is not complicated. It's hard sometimes for people to understand it, but it's a complicated process. It's the Constitution will not be changed. If these people read the Constitution, it gives the states the right to figure out how they're going to deal with the Electoral College. This does not do away with the Electoral College. It's still in place. You just count up the national vote, and when you send your electors to vote, they're required to vote for the person with the most votes. It's hard for me to understand how people can find this threatening and not a democratic way to go. I am very concerned about the young people who have sometimes just checked out, and we need to build confidence in our system and get them engaged, and it should be very visible and transparent. And I think the way it's going now, it is not, and it breeds just the opposite. I've been talking to a lot of people at town hall meetings and other meetings, and a large majority of the people I talk to are in favor of this. It takes a few minutes to figure out how it works, and then they go, well, of course, why wouldn't we in America, as an example to the world that we are, have one vote, one person? Thank you.
Hello, my name is Eileen Reavy, and I am here as an organizer for National Popular Vote Oregon, a grassroots coalition in support of having this bill passed in 2017. This is about making every vote matter, because it is in your hands. The U.S. Constitution gives this power to these states to determine how to pledge their electors. As a result, the Oregon legislature many years ago voted and decided to put this as a state winner-take-all system, and it is in your power to change this. This issue is not in response to the presidency or the individual that is currently in that office. This first came up here and was passed by this House in 2009, and personally, my interest in this issue started in 2000. I watched the election results, and it just did not make sense to me as someone learning about government how the person who didn't have the most votes won, but in every other race in the United States, that is how that person is elected. What really broke my heart was that my mother, who now at this point has voted in for the past 40 years in presidential elections, and as a Republican in Maryland, has never once had her vote feel like it matters. All of my friends, I hound them to vote, and they don't care. They really don't think it matters, and I hate to speak poorly on my generation, but they really don't. So I'm really hoping that this can change, and that we have a society in the future that more than 60% of our eligible voters actually show up at the polls for the presidency and for every down ballot race. We have a technological advancements that the founders never could have envisioned, and they've gone to us to the point where I can tweet at my president and maybe even get a response. but when I go to the polls, my vote for that person is not actually for that person. And technology has gotten to us to a point where it is time that one person should be worth one vote in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Callahan, Elaine Woods, and John Woods.
Yeah.
remember to say your name for the record.
Good afternoon, members of the House Rules Committee. My name is Mark Callahan. I live in East Portland. I'm a former U.S. Senate candidate, and I'm here to testify against the passage and urge a no vote on the NPV bill stated in HB 2927. HB 2927 goes against the very fabric and foundation of our great country and disadvantages rural voters, effectively disadvantaging rural voters in favor of those that live in the most populous of cities. Our founders debated this over 240 years ago when our country was founded and decided that our country was to be a republic, not a democracy. There is a difference between a republic and a democracy. A republic is a form of government in which the powers of sovereignty are vested in the people and are exercised by the people, either directly or through representatives chosen by the people to whom those powers are specifically delegated. A democracy is the form of government in which the sovereign power resides and is exercised by the whole body of free citizens directly and indirectly through a system of representation. Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, mine's a little worn here, use it a lot. Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which Samantha will be passing out to you here shortly, if she hasn't already, the U.S. Constitution guarantees every state in a Republican form of government. No state may join the U.S. unless it is a republic. NPV goes against the liberty and justice for all, including rural voters. In a democracy, 51% beats 49%, thus disenfranchising voting minorities. Democracy is a dictatorship of the majority. Please vote no on House Bill 2927. Thank you.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you. My name is Elaine Woods, and I'm a resident of Beaverton, Washington County. I also strongly oppose HB 2927. As has been stated, the Constitution has instituted the Electoral College, and so each state is seen as an electoral district. Also in the Constitution, the states are allowed to determine how those electoral votes are distributed. So if people don't like the way that so many states give winner-take-all, they have the opportunity to change that. Also, for the disputed results, all existing recount laws address elections in states, whereas with a national popular vote, the nation as a whole is considered the electoral district. So regardless of how all of the citizens of Oregon vote, and no matter how our electors are instructed to vote, the election will be determined by the national popular vote, whether Oregon has gone along with that or not. So in reality, national popular vote takes away the voice of Oregon. And if there are disputed results, which there have been of late, those laws, again, are addressed at the state level, and there is no provision for looking at things in a national electoral district. With a national electoral district, it implies a national cohesive identity, but we have become very partisan. There is also a problem with legitimacy because, as has been stated, the Constitution... Oops. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is John Woods. I'm a gun guy, but my wife dragged me into this NPV vote thing. So I would like to discuss some of the things I found. What I found is I have a real question about why we are doing this. This circumvents the amendment process of the Constitution. If you want a national popular vote, put it through an amendment. Get two-thirds to actually vote for it, and let's do it. The other thing is the effects will eliminate the states. We will disappear. We have 4 million people in Oregon. There's three or four counties in New York that have 3 or 4 million people. If they decide to vote opposite, Oregon disappears, literally disappears. The proposal will be extremely expensive. Like Elaine mentioned, the states are set up for state recounts. How do you do that? When you pour it all in one big hopper, how do you get it to do? And if you sign up for a compact and one state of that compact says, we agree with the election or we disagree with the election and we're not going to do a recount, are you going to have New York telling Oregon to do a recount? Or are you going to have Washington telling Oregon to do a recount because they need to do it? The other thing is, the last point I want to make is getting states to cooperate. We had a problem with Oregon and Washington even cooperating to get a bridge over the Columbia River. So how are we going to get 50 states to cooperate, literally? And how are you going to have, do you actually want New York to come into Oregon and say, you need to do this? Or Texas or Florida or whichever side? I don't. And the other thing is, Trump and Clinton both ignored Oregon because Trump couldn't win here, and Hillary already had the votes, and she didn't need to come here. So we were neglected.
And Amy Kessler, Carol Woolman, and Laurel Hines.
You'd like, just make sure to say your name for the record.
Great. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Kessler, and I am here on behalf of the Bus Project in support of House Bill 2927, the National Popular Vote Bill. The Bus Project supports National Popular Vote because we believe that every vote matters and every voice should be heard in every election. The current system of electing the president is flawed. Out of 45 presidents, five of them have been elected without receiving the most votes nationwide. Two of those were in the last 20 years, meaning that young voters, voters between the ages of 18 and 29, have seen two of those elections in their lifetime where the candidate for whom they overwhelmingly voted as a group was not elected, despite winning the popular vote. There is no bigger deterrent to participating in our democratic process than feeling disenfranchised by that process. When your vote counts for less than votes in other states, or when your state isn't considered a swing state and thus candidates avoid them altogether, it's hard to be motivated to participate. State winner-take-all statutes mean that presidential candidates have no reason to pay attention to the issues of concern to voters in states where the statewide outcome is a foregone conclusion. In 2012, two-thirds of the general election campaign events were in just four states, Ohio, Florida, Virginia, and Iowa, meaning that many states, including Oregon, were largely ignored. The current system creates a self-perpetuating cycle that discourages young voter turnout and allows a few states to determine the outcome of our nation's elections. By passing national popular vote, Oregon would join the 10 other states and the District of Columbia that have already enacted the compact and move us further down a path where one person equals one vote, and that our president would be nominated by popular vote. Thank you for your time and your consideration on this important issue.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Carol Woolman from Multnomah County, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and the committee. The U.S. Electoral College is a poster child for Jefferson's fears that a constitution may linger beyond its natural life. When the Founding Fathers conceived of the Electoral College as a small number of men most capable of analyzing the complicated question of who should be president, there were fewer eligible voters in the whole country than there are now just in the city of Portland. There were only 2.5 million people in the whole country. And only a fraction of those white, wealthy Protestant men were allowed to vote. We did try to amend the Constitution. We came a ways out of the 18th century by allowing men who aren't white to vote, by allowing women to vote, and by allowing voters to elect their own senators. The United States is the only country in the world still inserting an electoral college between voters and the presidency. A candidate could win with just 22% of the popular vote if you do the math, and win the presidency, and a candidate who has won the presidency with just 31% of the popular vote. The winner-take-all basis system results in a host of ills for our country.
counterintuitively, the candidate who gets the most votes is not necessarily where to win the presidency. Presidential candidates ignore 80% of Americans and spend all their time and money campaigning in just a few battleground states. And favoritism towards battleground states doesn't stop after the votes are counted. Presidents and their staff members have spent a lot of time listening and thinking about the issues important to those battleground states, but no time on the issues important to the spectator states like Oregon. To wit, where Donald Trump held his celebration rallies in Florida, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Alabama. Voters and spectators' states correctly sense that their votes for president do not matter.
My name is Laurel Hines, and I'm from Salem. And I am for this this measure. And I agree with many of the other speakers and the points that they made in favor of it. And just yesterday, I was listening to an Oregon Public Broadcasting podcast about some researchers that did a study on young people, millennials, those 35 and under. And they found that many of them are disenchanted and said that they think their vote doesn't count. And I think this measure would really help that situation and get young people back into the political process to feel like their vote counts. And I think that the Constitution, as the last person said, the Constitution had a number of flaws, that they didn't expect people to be more educated. They didn't think women would eventually have the right to vote. That sort of thing. We have to be flexible, and we have to make some changes for the fact that voters are now more educated. The rest of the world, most countries, in fact, I don't know if any other countries have an electoral system like ours. We need to join the modern world and make every vote count. People are intelligent. They can pay attention to the issues. They can pay attention to what the person they're voting for is like. And as we said, they do it in the state. We elect all of you have been elected by a popular vote. So I think it's time to change this situation. And I feel right now like Oregon doesn't have the vote, that our votes don't count because we don't live in Ohio. We don't live in a battleground state. So, and one person who was against this measure said there would be a constitutional crisis if this passed, and I think that's just ridiculous. So I hope you consider this issue and finally pass it. It's really time to get this passed. Thank you very much.
And the next panel is Tim Cowan and Rebecca Roth.
Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. I wrote so many notes because of what are the things that people have said. I'm against this bill. Electoral College ensures that the President of the United States has both sufficient popular support, but is also distributed throughout the country as opposed to controlled by large states and cities. The question I would have is, who's sponsoring this on a nationwide basis? And there's been talk about we don't have presidential candidates visiting us because we don't have a popular vote. Well, where are they going to go? They're going to go to New York and L.A. and some of those places. Why? Because they want to go for the popular vote. Now, since each senator represents each state equally, it allowing for more advantage to the smaller states because it's not based on population. The Electoral College maintains the federal system of government and representation. The United States was the first one to have a federal government, which means it's smaller and the power goes to the states. Abolishing the Electoral College in favor of a national popular election for president would strike at the federal structure laid out in the Constitution and would lead to a larger central government at the detriment of the smaller states. The large central government would create programs, large programs, and changing the very nature of our republic at the expense of local minorities. When I was I'm not going to go into that because it has my written testimony. Thank you.
Chair and committee, my name is Rebecca Roth, and I also was taking notes. And the percentage that it requires to elect a person is solely determined on how many parties there are that submit a candidate. In many countries that have a national vote, they might elect a candidate with 10% of the vote because they have 20 parties, and they don't have our whole system is set up where we eliminate candidates in the primary so that in the general we have only a few candidates so that we can achieve a large majority of people electing our representatives. And we were a bunch of states that got together and created the federal government. The federal government is supposed to be limited, and the power is supposed to go to the states. And already we have one person, one vote. We already have a popular vote in the state of Oregon and in each state. We have 50 popular votes. It's a celebration of sovereignty. Each state is a sovereign state and created the federal government. We don't want to give up our sovereignty to a national system where we are in a big pool that doesn't, where we're not expressed as a sovereign state. I have never, ever in my entire lifetime had my candidate win because in Oregon, because Oregon always votes for the Democrat ticket. And so the electors have always not voted for my vote, but I have always been proud to have Oregon have a voice in our national choice of a president. It's the only person that we elect as a nation. All of the other representatives that we have are elected from our state to represent us as a state. So
thank you very much.
Kathleen Babio. Okay. Will Hobbs, Linda Gabs Merlin, and Sarah Bile.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Will Hobbs. I'm from Washington County. And I've been thinking about the national popular vote for quite some time. And after this election, I did some analysis. I think you have the foils that I submitted to Samantha. It shows that our votes are not equal across the country. The Electoral College violates the one person, one vote ideal. And in fact, it takes 3.2 times as many votes to elect an elector in California as it does in Wyoming. In general, the less populous a state, the more powerful your vote. I don't think people should be penalized because they've moved to a populous state. And that's exactly what happens with the Electoral College. Your vote loses power. The winner-takes-all method of awarding electoral votes, which is used by all but two states, creates swing states, as we've talked about today, and results in a large number of wasted votes, and I want to talk about wasted votes a little bit. Take California, for example. There were many tens of thousands of votes cast beyond a simple majority that was needed to give the electoral votes into one candidate. All those votes are wasted. They have absolutely no further impact on the outcome of the election. The other thing that happens with swing states is you have huge resources, and the swing states are identified years in advance, so you know where to apply the resources, you know where to do any fraudulent things to suppress votes or swing the election in any way you might be able to. It defines what I would call a chaotic system. Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Bly, and I'm from North Plains, Oregon.
I'm in Representative Brad Whitt's district. I became interested, as he did, in the National Popular Vote legislation some time ago when I first heard about it, not this recent election. And there are several reasons that I support HB 2927, but two I will mention in particular. One is that it does give each person a vote in electing the President of the United States, and your argument was excellent about how that doesn't happen right now. Congress does represent the states. I understand that that is important, that our states are represented as well, but Congress does that in two bodies, the Senate and the House of Representatives. So it's appropriate that the president represent the people, one person, one vote. Two, the Electoral College has gone through some major changes in the past years without changing the Constitution. In particular, the current winner-take-all allocation of our electors that exists in most states, certainly in Oregon, doesn't serve us well. Even if a candidate wins a state by only a small margin, all the electors of that state go to only one candidate, a fact of which I'm sure you're well aware. This means that only a few voters in close races have the greatest influence in the overall election. And we've talked a lot about disenfranchising today, and I believe that certainly disenfranchises a significant percentage of our population. I would highly urge you to support HB 2927. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chairman and the committee members. I, too, am from Brad Whitt's district. My name is Linda Gallis-Merton. And I'm here in favor of House Bill 2927. Under the current system, my vote for the president, whether it's regardless of which party he or she belongs to, does not count. The Electoral College system has evolved over many years into a winner-take-all system, and it's a scheme that favors battleground states. I want the Electoral College system to favor one person and one vote. This kind of system, if we enact it, would guarantee that all votes be counted equally, that my vote in Oregon will be equal to another's vote in Virginia or Florida or any other state. There are 12 states right now that determine our president. I want that to change so that all citizens share equally in that decision. A few things that were said here today I feel are factually inaccurate. There are some people who say that small states, that we as Oregonians give up a lot of our standing by giving up votes to people in New York. It turns out that 15% of people in this country, the populace in this country, live in large cities. The rest of us live outside of very large cities. So 85-86% of us don't live in big cities. So it's hard for me to get that math right. How do big cities then overcome everybody else? Thank you very much.
And Stephen Keller, Karen Song, Rachel Osratich.
We have one more panel.
Okay. And after this, we have one more panel of people who've signed up. So if there's anybody who wants to testify who is not signed up, please go see Samantha. Then Dr. Kozo will come back up for some questions from the committee.
My name is Rachel Osratich, and I'm from Benton County, Madam Chair, and committee members, thank you. I am also a member of the League of Women Voters and also the NAACP, and this is very strongly related. Our election procedures are very strongly related to the strength of our democracy. If we want to still call it a democracy, we need to make it more of a democracy where more our votes are more equally counted. And this is a particular obvious way in which they are not. It's not well known by people that a state like Wyoming, for example, and other states that are small in population have only three electors, but no less. They all have at least three. And states like California have 55 electors, and that sounds like a lot. But when you divide the population by the elector, you get, for Wyoming, 170,000 people are represented by that elector. And in California, that elector represents 670,000. So that's made those 670,000, their votes, much, much, much less equal to the votes in Wyoming. And that's and the you can say that, well, the founding fathers had equality of the small states, the rural areas in mind, but in actuality, they were fallible. We know they were fallible. I mean, it used to be that the state legislators appointed senators. Senators were not elected by the people. And it was only through, I can't remember the, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Karen Sung. The constitutional question that was brought up is that if Oregon were to change the rules, then it would violate the Constitution. I would like to differ on that. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 specifically states, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislatures thereof may direct. And that line, legislatures thereof, is the key line that was used in Bush v. Gore. And Scalia used that line specifically in a concurring opinion saying that states had the power to appoint their electors in whichever way they choose, and that the state's laws would therefore become a federal question, a constitutional question. So with that in mind, Oregon should pass the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact primarily because it would incent voters of both parties, both Republican and Democratic, knowing that Oregon is a deep blue state. Both Democrats and Republicans don't feel this urge to vote. Now, if it were a nationwide level, that would be different. And going into the discussion of small states versus large states, this is not about small states or protecting small states. It's about protecting swing states. Currently, campaigning harvests money from non-swing states and distributes it into swing states, and that also affects governance. So emergency federal funds would go to swing states, knowing that these presidential candidates would have to campaign there again. So with the threat of an earthquake coming up that was written up in the New Yorker, I would like to know that our state would have emergency federal funds. On top of that, rural voters are 1/6 of the population. Urban voters are also 1/6 of the population. Suburban voters are 2/3 of the population. So if it's about protecting rural voters versus urban voters, I would like to dispel that myth as well and incent the general public to vote.
Madam Chair, Representatives, Steve Keller, District 46. Thank you for taking the time for this hearing.
Can you push the microphone closer to your mouth? Thank you.
That the U.S. Constitution is the first written document of its kind on the planet is both an honor and a burden. The founders saw fit that the document remain relevant by providing means of amending it by future representatives of the U.S. citizenry. On September 17, 1787, the Constitution was signed after ratification by the necessary 9 out of 13 U.S. states. The mere fact that only 9 states were required to ratify speaks volumes of how the demands upon the Constitution have increased with time, but also how a few states can make a difference. Obviously, the parchment has faded, and so too have some of the clauses declared relevant at inception. While the Electoral College was a necessary logistical means of tabulating votes during the days of horse and buggy, the mechanism is now both dated and effective only in denying the will of the majority. As proven by the 2016 national election for president, one could reasonably argue that there exists at least one worse condition than a tyranny of the majority, that being the tyranny of the minority. As reflected in the spirit of those limited quantity of states ratifying our national constitution, please provide Oregon a historic means to guide greater national democratization by supporting the will of the majority in the national presidential elections. Your historic vote for HB 2927 will be a vote to exercise our state's right to demand greater democracy. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ethan Scarl, Sharon Thornagel, and Sylvia Loftus.
Honorable Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members, I'm Ethan Scarl from HD 46. Not only is the country very different from what our founding fathers knew, but the Electoral College itself is a radically different institution than what they had put together. They envisioned a place where the leadership from around the country could get together and debate and determine what is best for the country as a whole. That is not what is happening today. The electors are roboticized. They are forced in their vote. And in fact, if they vote wrong, so to speak, they can actually be punished for a wrong vote. This is not an institution that I think the founders would defend at this point. The other constitutional issue is that far from defying the Constitution, this bill would have Oregon do precisely what the Constitution tells us to do, which is to define the selection and role of our own of our state's legislators, electors, and that is precisely the constitutional role here. The one argument of the people on who oppose this bill that I think holds any water is that Oregon's popular vote would not directly control the votes of the electors, and it would be watered down. We'd be voting as Americans rather than Oregonians. That is true, if that is a downside. The upside, it would be that if this is passed and other states join in properly, never again would this country be governed by a capriciously selected president who lost an election.
Madam Chair and honored members of the committee, I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here. I'm Sylvia Loftus from Salem. Paul Evans is my representative. And I'm happy to be here because I'm demonstrating, as all the people behind me are, what participatory democracy is about. And I'm so thrilled to see all the people behind me. And I know they don't all agree with me, but I know that they all would agree with one person, one vote. And that is something that we all strive for. Not so very many years ago, I was a naive and idealistic teenager who was selected as the governor of Delaware, girl state. Well, I had to come up with a speech to give to everybody, like a state of the state speech. And so I looked at Delaware's constitution and I scratched my head and I thought, wow, this is really out of date. So that's what my speech was about. It was about taking a look and reviewing the Delaware state constitution to see if it could be made any better. Needless to say, that didn't go over too well with the Daughters of the American Revolution who sponsored Girl State. But I am still interested in the idea that the basic foundation elements of our democracy are subject to and can be amended to be made better. And I believe that this is a measure that has been well researched over the several years it's been floating around. I believe it's a sound measure. I believe the reasoning behind it is very firm and very solid. And I urge your support. Thank you.
My name is Sharon Thornagel, and I'm just a plain old citizen. I live in Polk County, and my husband and I have a small farm, so we're considered rural voters. And I support this measure because I'm 70 years old. My 21st birthday, I went and registered to vote because I value my opportunity to vote, and I have voted in every single election. I want other people to value my vote as much as I do, and I don't think that's happening right now. I think that the Electoral College is able to be manipulated and that we don't all have our own voice, and so be it. If there are large areas that the candidates go to, they're going to do that anyway, because they're going to go for the Electoral College, and we probably will get less information directly here in Oregon anyway. unless people start feeling like every single vote does count. And I want my vote to count just like everybody else's. And that is why I am here and urging you to vote for 2927. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is the end of our sign-up sheet for testimonies. We asked Dr. Koza to come back up. I know there are committee members who have questions. Thank you. Representative Nos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I was listening very intensely, especially to the folks that are in opposition to this measure, and there were two things that they raised that sort of struck me, and I was wondering if you could either offer us some insight about it. The first one was with regard to the compact clause in Article 1, I think it's in Section 10 of the United States Constitution. It seems to me to read like, is the kind of compact that's contemplated by this measure what's contemplated in that article, that part of the United States Constitution, or is that referring to something else? Has this been litigated in some way so that there's some clarity about what kind of compact that is?
Chairman Williamson and Representative Nos, the Supreme Court has ruled in 1893, and then the Rehnquist Court reaffirmed in 1978.
Dr. Koza, can you pull the microphone closer to you?
And start over just so we can hear that again.
The Supreme Court has ruled in 1893, and then the Rehnquist Court reaffirmed in 1978 the principle that an interstate compact only requires congressional consent if it threatens federal supremacy. And the Supreme Court has also ruled repeatedly that the decision on how a state awards its electoral votes is exclusively a state function of the state legislature. So not only is it not a threat to federal supremacy, there's no federal power in this area in the first place. So under those precedents, this particular compact, like a majority of compacts to date, do not require congressional consent. If that precedent were ever changed, for example, if it was litigated after this compact reaches its requisite number of states, then it would require congressional consent if the Supreme Court ruled that way.
I don't have a follow-up, but I do have a second question, Madam Chair. Okay, so my other question was about the issue of fraud. So another witness suggested that there might be a state that would cast millions of fake ballots for a candidate to swing the election. And while I don't believe we have a lot of evidence of that happening, it certainly is possible. How would that be handled or dealt with?
Well, one of the early witnesses made two points. One is he said that the leadership of a state could arrange things to avoid, for example, a recount. Well, if you recall, the crucial state in the 2016 election was Pennsylvania, which one candidate won by 40,000 votes, and a recount was requested, and the candidate who was ahead, as usual, as all candidates who are ahead like to do, they went to court and got the courts of Pennsylvania to prevent the recount from happening. The same thing, by the way, that happened in Florida in 2000 and Michigan in 2016. The previous witness also mentioned that a state might have voting machines that create no auditable record and could therefore not be recounted. Well, the state that has the most such voting machines of that type is Pennsylvania. So here we see a real potential problem avoiding a recount and having voting machines that can't be recounted. Well, where did it happen? It happened in the state that determined the outcome of the last presidential election. So the reality is we do need good voting systems. We certainly don't want fraud. But the reality is that if you have a pool of 140 million votes, the shenanigans that might have gone in a state like Pennsylvania, because it's a crucial battleground state to decide at the election, would be washed out in the large national outcome. Nobody wants imperfect outcomes, but the current system magnifies the possibility of fraud. It magnifies the incentive of fraud in the battleground states, because those are the states that are close and where a very small number of people, by committing a fraud, can flip the entire national result.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Vice Chair McClain.
Sir, thank you for being here to testify. What is the underlying premise of the national popular vote movement?
Well, the underlying premise is that every person's vote in every presidential election in every state should be politically relevant.
May I follow up? And do you, having the one person, one vote premise, I'm curious as to whether you have criticism of the United States Senate.
I have no criticism of the United States Senate. The United States Senate is established in the U.S. Constitution, and in fact, the composition of the Senate cannot be changed except by unanimous votes of the states, even by a constitutional amendment.
And a follow-up. And I appreciate your recitation of the Constitution, which I agree that's what it says. But I guess my curiosity, though, is why wouldn't you want to also change the Senate, given the premise of the national popular vote?
Because we have a system of government with checks and balances. We have a House of Representatives with short terms that represent small districts and the people somewhat more closely than the Senate. And then we have, in effect, the senatorial districts, which are the states, representing or being the basis for the presidential election. And each is a check and balance on the other. To pass legislation in Washington requires concurrent majorities. You have to have a majority of the House, the Senate, and the president has to be on your side. Under the concurrent majorities and the checks and balances, you have a mixed system. We would have more of a mixed system with more checks and balances if the president was removed from the same districts as the Senate and we had a single national constituency for the president.
May I follow up? So would you agree that votes in Oregon for the United States Senate have more weight than votes in California?
They do in the U.S. Senate, that's correct.
Then why wouldn't, given the weighted votes for Oregonians or, say, Wyoming, the same premise require you to advocate for revocation of the Senate's allocation based upon a state being equal as opposed to popular vote?
Because I believe in the way the Constitution was set up with checks and balances and concurrent majorities. And by the way, a vote for president in Oregon is equivalent to a vote for president in California and is equivalent to a vote for president in Wyoming. They are all three totally irrelevant to the outcome of the presidential election.
May I follow up? Why is, then, given your answer as to the U.S. Senate, why do you ignore the validity of the states participating in electoral college when you permit the states to have equal footing regardless of population in the Senate?
Because our Constitution has a system of checks and balances with concurrent majorities. The Senate represents the states. The House of Representatives represents very small districts and the people with shorter terms. The president has a different term, and they all overlap. And currently the president represents 12 states and ignores 38 states. We think that the country would be better off if that one part of the system was changed so that the president represented all the people of the United States.
All right. Madam Chair, I'm just curious because of the premise that ultimately it seems curious that the proponents, or at least the premise for one vote, one person, would be satisfied with the Constitution and its origin in 1787 in part, and yet be dissatisfied in another part. I wonder if outcomes have dictated philosophy, at least when with regards to consistency as to that notion. I've always voted against the popular vote because of believing that the states have some meaning still. I question whether the inconsistency that I'm hearing is remedied by erasing, in essence, the Electoral College. I'm curious. I'm always open to new ideas, but I haven't heard one here today, nor have I heard anything that as to ignoring the popular vote, ignoring 1787 framework as to states' legitimacy with equality amongst each other, but yet when it comes to the president, it is. Again, I wonder if it's dictated more by dissatisfaction with outcomes as opposed to ultimately the premise, but that's why we have, of course, votes here, and it is 51% in the House, and so I'm sure that this will move out of this committee and over my vote and across the House over my vote, and ironic as that is. Thank you.
Senator Brayfield.
I just had a quick question. Was it the framers' intent that the states should be able to choose how to apportion their electoral college votes?
Representative Rayfield, thank you for asking that question and making that point, because one of the previous witnesses referred to this as not being the proper way to achieve the goal that we're trying to achieve. The Constitution has 17 words to say about what the proper way is to change the method of electing the president. It says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof shall direct a number of presidential electors. And that is precisely the power that the state of Oregon exercised when you adopted the winner-take-all law here in Oregon years ago. And that is a state law which can be changed by another state law. It does not take a federal constitutional amendment to change a state law any more than it takes a federal constitutional amendment to repeal Obamacare. The winner-take-all law is ordinary state legislation and may be changed in the very same way it was enacted, namely by action of the state legislature, which is the body that the founding fathers specified has the exclusive power to decide how the president is elected.
And then just one follow-up. How were, in the initial framers, how did they decide the Senate? How were we supposed to elect our Senate when we talking about the founding fathers in the way that we were initially set up to elect our Senate members?
Well, in fact, since Oregon is the home of the 17th Amendment, the original Constitution in 1789 specified that the state legislatures elected the U.S. senators. And that continued until 1912, I believe, or 1913, somewhere in through there. After Oregon initiated the so-called Oregon Plan, by which it used state legislation to conduct a popular statewide advisory vote for U.S. Senate, and the legislators, because of political pressure and agreement, agreed to follow the voters' lead. And by the time the 17th Amendment was adopted as a federal constitutional amendment, 29 states had followed Oregon's lead and adopted the Oregon Plan or something very close to it. So that the Senate was, for all practical, a majority of the Senate was already being elected by the people at the time the constitutional amendment eventually passed. And that is indeed thanks to the state of Oregon for taking the lead on that.
I could spend hours with you or just read your 1,000-page book.
Well, someone emailed me and said they read the everything but the appendix in 3 hours. And
fast read.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just can't help but observe the sort of history lesson that I'm getting today. And one thing I remember is that from eighth grade U.S. American government is that the Senate and the House were a compromise so that big states and small states would not overrun each other. The idea was, if I remember correctly, that the House was going to be based on population, right? And so there'd be if you were from a large state, your state was going to have more power, all right? In theory, if you could unify. But then, you know, if you're a small state, you had more power in the Senate, and that was the balance between the two, so that large states and small states didn't necessarily swing the day.
Thank you.
I think I'm remembering that right.
Additional questions? All right, well, thank you
very
much.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you all for being here and for being so respectful of each other's time so we could get through everyone today. And with that, I will adjourn. I will close the public hearing and I will adjourn the committee. Thank you. I will adjourn the committee. Thank you. I will close the public hearing and I